Because some of you were not there last week, let me just summarize in two sentences the gist of the talks last week. The first talk, we argued that when they are being addressed, children tend to interpret the content of communication as generic to the object kind represented by a referent. And the second talk, Jury argued that such a tendency is helpful for learning opaque instrumental knowledge from others by communication. Now, both of these claims imply that children register when they are the target of someone's communication and can recognize at least some referential expressions embedded in the communication. So today, I'm going to argue for two proposals. First one is that human infants are innately endowed with some abilities to recognize and represent communicative intention addressed to them. So the two proposals I'm going to put forward today is that human infants are innately endowed with some abilities to understand communicative intention addressed to them in a very special and limited sense, as I'm going to describe it. And the second is that they can quickly learn about referential signals, which are special to their environment, because they expect that communication addressed to them to be referential. And again, this is an innate assumption that they apply. So let's start with the first point. Paul Grice's famous analysis of communicative meaning goes something like this. A speaker meant something by uttering X is true if and only if for some audience or hearer a speaker uttered X intending that the hearer produce a particular response, and second, then the hearer recognized that the speaker intended him to produce a particular response. And there is a third clause as well, which we are not going to deal with. The point I brought this to you here just to show the crucial insight in this Gricean analysis of communicative intent, that whenever you try to understand communication addressed to you, you would attribute to the communicator at least two different kinds of intentions. First, to produce a particular response, and second is to make that intention manifest. So a communicative act attempts to fulfill at least two intentions simultaneously, and one of them makes reference to the other one. In other words, there is a first order intention here and the second order intention here, because it refers to the first one. Now, there is a different way to formulate exactly the same kind of insight in relevance theory, in which Dan Sperber and Deirdre Wilson refer to the same two kinds of intentions with different names. They call them informative intention, to make manifest some content for the audience, and communicative intention, to make manifest or mutually manifest the communicator's informative intention. This is the same insight. I'm going to use these terms, informative intention and communicative intentions, for the distinction between the two kinds of intentions, between the first and second order intentions here. Now, if this is true, then it's also true that one cannot hold a communicative intention without holding the corresponding informative intention, because it implies that it refers to the first order intention. But what we are interested in today is not what communicative intentions, producing communicative intentions imply, but about the other side, the receptive communication. So if we turn around the same picture, then you would say that to comprehend a communicative act, one has to attribute to the communicator two different intentions: an informative intention with some inferred content, and a communicative intention to make the informative intention manifest. Now, unlike in the production side, where one cannot have a communicative intention without the corresponding informative intention, it's not the case in the receptive side. You can understand that someone is trying to communicate to you even without knowing, without figuring out what the content of the informative intention is. So when someone talks to you in a foreign language that you don't understand, you would understand that you are being addressed by communication without knowing the content of the communication is. So in this case, you would say that what you do, what the addressee does here, is to create, it understands the generally the communicative intention of the communicator and creates a placeholder for that informative intention, and of course tries to fill it with some with some kind of content in some way. So one implication of this is that recognizing communicative and informative intentions could be separated from each other. I mean, even cognitive mechanisms, cognitive processes, they could be separated from each other, and the former can precede the latter. So the recognizing communicative intention can precede the recognizing the corresponding informative intentions. Now, one way that this can be implemented is using ostensive signals. The main idea here is that while recovering the content of the informative intentions is always an inferential process. You have to figure out what exactly the content of that other wants to communicate to you. It's not necessarily true for the communicative intent. Of course, sometimes you can infer that someone has a communicative intent, but because the meaning of the communicative intent is quite simple, that there is an informative intent behind it, it can be coded into a simple code system. So you can have dedicated signals with the meaning that the communicative intention is present, implying that there is an underlying informative intention is present. I will call these signals ostensive signals, and they fulfill two different functions. They indicate that the accompanying or subsequent actions of the source of these signals are meant to reveal the informative intention of the source, and also they specify the addressee of this intention. And so the claim here is that with these ostensive signals, one can directly, the communicative intention, the presence of communicative intention of others can be directly understood. Okay, let me just skip this. Now, for infants, the point is that if this is true, then it is possible to suggest that infants may be able to decode ostensive signals before they can extract the content of the corresponding informative intention. All they have to do is just to be sensitive to these ostensive signals and interpret them as such, as in the indicators of the presence of communicative intentions. In this case, infants may recognize that someone has a communicative intention towards them before they can infer what is the content of this intention. Now, to be able to start this process at all, they need an initial code system, something that would tell them that a communicative intention is present. So we suggest that newborns are innately sensitive at least three different kinds of ostensive signals. These are eye contact. This is a communicative signal which is universal across human cultures. But interestingly, eye contact has a different meaning, at least extended eye contact has a different meaning in other species. Certain types of intonations, which maybe not universal, but many, many cultures use them to address infants, and they can therefore act as ostensive signals telling the infants that they are being addressed. They sound like this. Okay, someone switched off the sound, so it doesn't sound like this. I will need the sound back later on, so. Okay. And contingent reactivity. So if you do something, a certain action, and you consistently receive signals reactions to your action, then it may suggest that someone is trying to communicate to you. It's not necessarily that that's the case, but under some circumstances, you may come up with the hypothesis that this contingent reactivity indicates that someone is trying to communicate to you. Now, I'm not going to review all the literature on this, on newborn sensitivities to various kinds of stimuli, but I want to show you that we know that infants are sensitive to eye contact stimuli. They prefer them. That if they can choose, they can look at them compared to other similar stimuli. And not newborns, but a little bit later, 2-3 months old, start to smile in response to this kind of signal. This is exactly the same case with infant-directed speech. Newborns are sensitive to them. To this kind of intonations. They prefer this kind of speech, and they start to smile in reaction to this as soon as they can. Again, the third kind of stimulus, exactly the same pattern holds. Newborns are sensitive to contingent reactivity. They prefer those kind of stimuli that give them these responses, and they smile to them. And the third important ostensive signal is your own name. Of course, if you hear your name, it's very likely that someone is addressing you. Infants, of course, they are not born with the knowledge of their name, but interestingly, this is the very first word that they can extract from continuous speech about 4.5 months of age. And as soon as they can do it, they prefer it. And they smile in response to it. So what follows from is that infants like being addressed. Because I don't have much time to go into the details, I'm just going to talk about one of these ostensive signals, eye contact, a little bit, just to show you some evidence that newborns and infants are really sensitive to these kind of signals. So perhaps the most direct evidence is this study, which we published many years ago, showing that if you show newborn infants two faces, one of them looking at them, the other is looking away, then they prefer to look at the one looking at them, whether you measure looking time or how many times they look at the stimuli, it doesn't matter. And if you look at these are individual newborns, I mean, it's a big majority which show a very clear preference to the stimulus, which we call eye contact stimulus. Since then, we know that it is the same if you use schematic faces. It doesn't have to be a real face, but the effect goes away if you turn the faces upside down. So it has to be an upright face. And it also, the effect is not there if the face is oriented towards one side, from which stimulus you can extract which one is the eye contact stimulus, which one is not, but newborns cannot do it. Interestingly, by 4 months of age, they can do this as well. Now, even here, you may be skeptical. So perhaps what happens here is that infants like faces, like upright faces, like symmetry. Perhaps these together would add together and give you the eye contact stimulus, upright, symmetric face, not looking anyway. Probably this is what they like. Interestingly, there is another aspect of this stimuli which is not frequently discussed, which make upright face eye contact stimulus, and it has to do something with the contrast polarity of the relations between the face features. Let me show you why. It is because the human eye's morphology differs from other primates' eye morphology, as you can see here. The main differences are that the human eyes are wider horizontally. They expose higher proportion of the sclera, which doesn't play any role in vision. So it's not necessary to expose them. And it's wide. And the result of this feature is that it's much easier to see where a person is looking than another primate species looking. And cartoon artists know this, so this is why they draw big white sclera to animals when you want to, and they want them anthropomorphize them, because these animals anyway they wouldn't have these big visible sclera there. And we also know that the human visual system relies on this feature heavily. So one good example of this is the Bogart illusion, where here you see Humphrey Bogart looking to the right. This is just the negative of the same picture, and I guess that for most of you he appears to look to the left, also, even if you know that he's looking to the right, simply because your visual system tries to tell the eye direction on the basis of the contrast polarity differences between the sclera and the iris. Now, interestingly, we showed that human newborns, are also sensitive to contrast polarity in face-like figures. So in this first contrast, you see that newborns liked the face-like figures compared to the upside-down arrangement of these face elements here. But this preference disappears when you change the contrast polarity, when these elements are no light on darker backgrounds, and it's independently whether the background is white or black. And even more interesting, that the preference comes back if you put back black dots into these white spots here. That is, if you give them back the contrast polarity that they should look for if they're looking for gaze, that is, black elements on white backgrounds, or at least dark elements or light backgrounds, then they again start to prefer face-like figures to the other figures. It suggests that it's what infants are looking for is not just faces, not just symmetry, but with some contrast polarity as well, exactly the kind of features that they should look for if they are interested in others' gaze. Just one more experiment on this. This is data from human adults, very simple experiment, and these kind of figures appear on the screen in front of humans, left or right, and they just have to look at them as soon as they can. There is no other task. And it turns out that if you measure the time it takes for them to start eye movements toward the stimuli, then people are much faster for the upright than to the inverted face stimulus. But only if they are they contain the right contrast polarity either because they are, these figures are on black on white, or you put them the little eyes into these sclera-like white spots. So it's a very similar effect as in newborns. Now, so these were newborns, but also it would be also interesting whether infants learn anything about these. These ostensive stimuli later, and second, is there any evidence more than just preference that would suggest that they interpret these stimuli as ostensive signals in the sense I described? So here's an experiment where we tried to address this question. Here the question was whether if you have two different signals which are both ostensive signals, whether the brain activity in response to these signals suggests that infants interpret them the same way. So this is what they see here. Look at the left side here. So there's a face there. There are two phases. The eyes move towards you, that's ostensive signal. And second, the smile with the eyebrow raised, which is also an ostensive signal, suggesting that it is communication to you. And we contrast that with the other stimulus here, where the only difference is that the eyes move again, away from you, but the second phase is exactly the same. The physical change is exactly the same, the smile and the eyebrow raise. And we measured in two different experiments, two different kinds of neural responses to these stimuli. The first one here, we measured gamma band EEG oscillations. I'm not going to explain what they are. But the main point here is that, so these are the two different, responding to two different kinds of stimuli. In case of eye contact stimulus, you get a response to this. This is coming from the frontal cortex. And then the face smiles and the eyebrow is raised, you get exactly the same response again. Crucially, you don't get the response when the face looks away from you. And second, when they see exactly the same change, right, the smile and the eyebrow gaze, they don't repeat the same response here, suggesting that they actually interpret these stimuli the same way in this case, but not in this case. There's another way also that we measured responses to these stimuli, and this is with near-infrared spectroscopy, which measures just the hemodynamic responses, similar kinds of measurements that you can measure with fMRI. And what we found here is a higher response to the ostensive stimuli than to the non-ostensive stimuli, and it's coming again from the frontal pole, which is a similar location where you would find effects, responses to ostensive stimuli in human adults. So to sum up, infants prefer eye contact. They attend to stimuli that contain potential gaze information, can extract neutral gaze from dynamic gaze even when the head is not oriented towards them. This was one kind of evidence for that in this study, because the head was not oriented to them. They respond to mutual gaze the same way as they do to other standard signals, like eyebrow raising, activate similar structures in response to mutual gaze to those of adults. Now, their sensitivity to these signals, actually not just eye contact, other signals as well, but I'm not going to the details of that, suggest that they are prepared to recognize communicative attentions addressed to them. If this is the case, then what they should do, if this is a communicative attention in the sense I described at the beginning, it's a second order intention, it implies that there is a first order informative intention somewhere, and they should start to search for that because they are being addressed with that. So in order to do so, they have to apply some kind of assumption to figure out how to extract the content of this informative attention. I think there are many of these assumptions that they can apply here. One of them, the genericity assumption. This is what I tried to suggest last week, that they use genericity assumption to infer the content of informative intentions of infant-directed communication. Today I'm going to talk about another expectation, which is the referential expectation. So infants have to learn various kinds of referential signals during their infancy and their childhood. They are actually not born with the knowledge of these signals, which is quite good, because these signals may differ from culture to culture. Both, of course, language, but not just language, even nonverbal signals may differ from culture to culture. Of course, there are overlaps as well. And these signals may refer to things in the world in many different ways. So words are primarily arbitrary symbols. Deictic gestures refer to objects by location. Iconic signs, like iconic gestures or pictures, refer to things by resemblance, and so on, and so on. Now, they have to learn, of course, how these signals refer to various kinds of things in the world. And it's often claimed in the literature, at least for the first two points, for words and for deictic gestures, that the initial learning of such signals is purely associative. So infants do not attach any meaning to them. They don't conceive them as referential signals. They just, when they hear a word and they see an object, they just simply just associate them. When they see a pointing gesture, for example, and then they detect there is an object there, they associate them, and because they like to see object, therefore they start to follow pointing. I'm going to argue against these ideas. So, and the argument, so what I try to claim here is that from the very beginning of learning of various kinds of referential signals, infants assume that there are signals that are referential, and that helps them to learn about these signals, and they are never just purely associative learning that they apply here. So I'm going to talk about mainly about deictic gestures, which individuate their referent bar location. And I'm going to talk about a very special kind of deictic gestures, which is usually not considered to be a deictic gesture, and this is gaze. Let me illustrate it with an example, what I mean here. Here is a classic study of word learning by Dared Baldwin. This is what happens. There's an adult and a child, and there are two objects in between them. The adult looks at one of the objects, the same one as the child, and says, "It's a toma." Later, when they are facing to each other and the two objects is in between them, she asks, "Can you point to the toma?" In this case, the child points to the proper object, so the one that she called a toma. There is not much surprise here. The interesting point comes with the other condition, where she says it's a toma, but it says this at the moment when they are looking at different objects. And the question, when later she asks the child, "Can you point to the toma?" Which one to the child points? And in this case, the child points to the object to which the adult looked when she told it's a toma. It's not the one that she looked at when she was told a toma. So this study demonstrates is that infants don't just associate words to things they can see when they hear the words, because otherwise they would associate the word toma with this object. But they do something else. Here's another version of the study. These were 16 to 18 months old, 1.5 years old, so something like that. Here's another version of the same study. In this case, the adult looks into a bucket and says, "It's a toma," right? The child cannot see what's in the bucket, right? And later, a couple of minutes later, an object comes out of the bucket, and then later the child asks, "Can you point to a toma?" And they can point to the object which was in the bucket. Again, here you cannot explain word learning by simply association of visual and auditory stimuli, because the visual stimulus was not there, and still the child could learn the name of this object. So what's the explanation of this result? So here is the mainstream explanation. It says that children can figure out which object is in the speaker's focus of attention, assume that people talk about objects they attend to, and then attach the novel label to the object that the speaker attended when uttering the word. Here is an alternative explanation. This is my explanation. Children comprehend nonverbal demonstrative referential signals, assume that concurrent referential signals refer to the same thing, and attach the novel label to the object that the nonverbal referential signal highlighted. Of course, both of these explanations refer to the fact that children are sensitive and pay attention to the adult's gaze direction in these studies. The difference is how they interpret gaze direction here. The first explanation suggests that children interpret gaze direction here as a sign of focus of attention, So they attribute certain intentional state to the adult, intentional state with the object as the target. And then from that intentional state, the infernal intentional state, some kind of communicative intent with the target. And then they think that there should be these two kinds of intentional state, the object of the two kinds of intentional state should match. The other explanation is that in the second one, gaze is directly interpreted as a referential signal, just like pointing. And in this case, what children have to do here is simply just to think that if she is referring by a nonverbal signal like gaze to something, and by a verbal signal, by a word to something, probably she is referring to the same thing. So it's just two kinds of action coming probably from the same intention. And therefore, the object of these two referential intentions should match. Therefore, I can attach to the label to the object. So here is the proposal that would explain this result this way. The proposal is that gaze is adapted for the expression of demonstrative reference during human evolution. Interpreting someone's object-directed gaze as evidence for seeing or attending to something, as evidence for communicatively referring to something, are not dependent on each other and are implemented in partly dissociable cognitive mechanisms. Here is a translation of the same claim for philosophers. It would say that beyond the natural meaning of object-directed gaze, which can indicate that the person can see or attends to a certain object, gaze can also convey the non-natural meaning of demonstrative reference to a certain object. And obtaining either meaning doesn't necessarily imply obtaining the other one as well, which simply just suggests that you can understand gaze as a communicative referential gesture without thinking about whether what the person can see, just like when I point to a closed box to refer to the content of the box, you would understand I'm referring to the content of the box and not the box. You can do it with gaze as well. I can look at a box, and by this action I can refer to this object without being able to see or being able to attend to the object the same way. So, what's the benefit of having this kind of interpretation of gaze? I'm going to use the example of gaze following here. So why would you follow someone's gaze? My suggestion here is that there are at least two different reasons why would you do that. First, you do it in order to see what the other person can see, to figure out the perceptual attentional state of the other. And the other reason is to figure out some part of the message of the communicative partner which could be essential for its interpretation. For example, if she says something, you want to figure out some argument of that communication. So I'm going to shortly argue this duality of interpretation of gaze in humans. I'm going to give you an evolutionary argument, some cognitive dissociations which would argue for them, and then come back to developmental issues, which is the main point of the talk today. The evolutionary argument is very simple. It is the same one that I also mentioned to you, that it is the unique morphology of the human eye, which is described many times in the literature, but sometimes interpreted in very, very strange ways. This is just one example from Kingston et al., who say that gaze can indicate sources of potential interest or danger in the environment. It is perhaps not surprising that human eye morphology, sclera to iris ratio, may have evolved to allow easy discrimination of small shifts in the eye direction of the other individual. I think this would be a very, very surprising explanation, because if this is an explanation that this would be an anatomical change in humans, that would benefit everyone else except the owner of the eyes, right? If the main point of this is that it would give some others some benefit, then it would be a kind of puzzle how it could develop. But if gaze is used for communication, right, then it's not just the benefit of the others that the eye position of humans is easily discernible, but also of the communicators, because he or she wants to be understood, right? So in this case, that would explain why this kind of anatomical change could emerge in the hominin evolution. For the other argument, I just refer to interesting dissociations between two species, or two groups of species. So one group would be non-human primates who follow gaze, we know that, and there is good evidence that they understand very well who can see what. This is just one example from a recent study from Flombaum and Santos. So in this case, they put a piece of, I think, raisin or some kind of food in between, in front of these two people. And then in this case, rhesus monkeys would preferentially steal the raisin from the person who is not looking towards them, or the one who covers the eyes and not the mouth as well. There are many other studies suggesting that primates are quite proficient in figuring out who can see what in the environment. In contrast to that, they are really, really poor in tasks where gaze would play a role of communicative reference. This is the famous object choice task, which they actually pass if the object choice task is when there's a two locations where something could be hidden, usually food with these animals. And they cannot see. It's not like the A not B task when infants actually can see where the object is hidden. They don't know where it is. But of course they could use some kind of cues from the human. So they usually pass the task if the human touches the location, or point to the location with the close point, or even just approaching to the location. But they fail if the person is just looking at one of the boxes. Either by head turn or by eye turn. Now, why would they fail that? They fail here because you can interpret the first three kinds of signals as approaching, as a kind of indication that this person is acting for a goal which is somehow related to that box, and they understand that. But here, there is no action towards this goal, just looking at them. And because the person cannot see anything here, just the closed box, therefore it doesn't suggest to them anything. Actually, there is a very good study by Joseph Kohl and colleagues when they contrasted these two kinds of signals. So when someone is looking into a tube, then chimpanzees will think that there is something interesting there, probably food, and they will search at that location. But if you're looking a box which is completely closed, so the person who is looking wouldn't be able to see anything, then they don't get the cue. They don't start to search there again, because they understand that seeing could be a cue for something, but just looking cannot be a cue for something. So these were primates. Let's see the contrasting example. The contrasting example is dogs. I'm not going to spend much time on this, but arguably dogs were selected to understand human communication. For example, they are the only non-human species that passes the object choice task with this kind of task that I just described, with gaze cues. Even young puppies without experience with humans are sensitive to human communication signals, while wolves are not. Dogs also understand other kinds of communication addressed to them, like marking locations by objects, they extend novel labels to novel objects. At least there is one study which suggests that. And they learn instrumental actions from human demonstration, communicative demonstration. At the same time, there is no good evidence that they will be very proficient in understanding who can see what. I know a couple of failed studies on this, which are not published, but even if you just look at the published studies, there is evidence that they do not actively seek information from humans in the object choice task. So if you indicate to them where the object, the target object is, they understand that even by looking, but they don't try to figure it out just from you. And they don't take into account others' knowledge state when they search for things. And finally, we are arriving back to infants, which is the main topic of this talk, and gaze following in infants. Now, the usual way how you study gaze following in human infants is in a very, very ostensive context. So you sit in front of the infant, you call their name, you get your attention to yourself by strong understanding signals, and then you turn your head or just eyes towards something, and then you see whether the infant follows your gaze or not. Interestingly, infants don't follow static gaze. What they follow is gaze shifts. So this is the usual example that Mike Tomasello's lab used to demonstrate gaze following in chimpanzees. And it's very, very clearly this is what they do. They follow the gaze of this person. But this is what human infants never do. Adults do that, but human infants never do that. Just to look somewhere without talking to them, they are not looking up. Also, infants pass the object choice task, we know that, but they only pass the object choice task if it's a very, very ostensive context. So you make sure that the infants understand that this looking is performed for them. And also, the more communicative cues are present, the more likely that they will follow the gaze. So all of these would argue against that they follow the gaze because they interpret, because they want to see what the other can see, because otherwise you wouldn't see these differences. But we wanted to test this more directly, whether gaze following depends on the presence of those ostensive signals that I listed to you in the beginning. So here is how we did this. We did this study with an eye tracker when we showed infants the person and two objects, and then the person looks at one of the objects with the question whether infants follow the gaze, whether they look at the same object as the person. But in between these two phases, something is happening. First, for example, the person looks up and there's eye contact. And the blue dot that you can see is the eye position of the infants. Don't know whether you observed here, but in this case, the infant actually followed the gaze. So the first gaze after the head turning went to the same object as the person looked at. And if you measure that across all the infants, that you get this gaze following score, which is different from zero in the positive way. It means that they follow gaze. And what happens if you remove the eye contact and replace it with some other stimulus, which draws infants' attention to the head, so it's clearly that they can see that the head is turning. In this case, there's almost no gaze following. Practically, they look randomly to the left or right. These are 6-month-old infants. Now, you may say that perhaps they don't follow the gaze here because they never see the eyes. First, they have to see the eyes. But it's not necessarily the case. The argument was that they didn't follow gaze because there was no eye contact, which would tell them that I'm performing this turning for you. So what happens is we replace this eye contact with some kind of other ostensive signals, which would suggest them that this is performed for them. For example, infant-directed speech. So this is a very short speech. This is a single word. single word, but the intonation is the kind of intonation that you would use with an infant, with exaggerated pitch contours and so on. And in this case, what happens is that they actually follow the gaze. And you can contrast it with another situation where they can see the same bird, the volume is the same, the voice is the same, except they don't get this exaggerated pitch contour. So this is what we call adult directed speech, and again, gaze following disappears. Now, I'll show you a third study which tried exactly the same procedure with the third kind of ostensive signal I mentioned to you, contingency. So what happens here is that infants see these kind of objects which are not even human beings, like this is the middle one. And the middle one sometimes turn to the left or to the right, as if it would turn to one or the other object. Now the crucial difference here, or the crucial manipulation here, is that this middle one, for one group of infants, this is contingently behaving to their gaze. So whenever they look at this object, this teapot like thing, a little bit animated, but only when the infant looks at them. So they can actually control this teapot by their gaze. So here it is how it looks like. You see the gaze there. Whenever the infant looks at it, a little bit jumps a little bit. And then it turns, and the question whether they follow this gaze or not. And the answer is that they follow this gaze. And we contrast it with another situation where infants see exactly the same amount of animation of the middle object than in the other group. It is just not contingent with them, right? It's completely independent of from what they do. And we measure exactly the same thing, whether they would follow the gaze to the right or to the left object when this teapot turns. And the answer is no. So there are three different kinds of ostensive signals that we used here with these babies of 6 months old. These are, I think, a little bit older, maybe 7 months old babies. And we showed that whenever the gaze or the turning of an object follows ostensive signals, then infants tend to follow this signal. That is probably because they interpret it as a referential signal, but not when these gaze shifts or head turning occurs in out of communicative context. Now, in order to show that infants interpret gaze as a referential signal, so we'd also have to show that they expect to find something there. Here, that wasn't the case because they already could look around the scene and detect that there are objects there. So we don't have to expect to find an object there because they know that object's there. But what happens when you put them in a situation where they don't know where an object is, whether they can use gaze shifts in an ostensive context to figure out where objects are? So here is the study. Okay, so they can see this kind of event or this. Okay, so we'd find this one consistent and this one inconsistent event only if you think that the object should be at the location where the person looked at. So what we measured here is infant looking behavior to the empty sides of this screen, because we know that infants don't like to look at nothing. So if they look at nothing, that may suggest something. So what you see here in two different age groups, practically, that they look at the empty side more in the inconsistent case than in the consistent case. and this is true both absolute looking time or relative looking time, suggesting that they expected to find something at that location. Also, they change sides more times in the inconsistent case, again suggesting that they are searching for something which is not there where they expected. So infants follow gaze in ostensive context, and when they do so, they expect to find something. But again, you may be a skeptic and say that perhaps this is still not enough to show that infants interpret these signals as truly referential signals. There is no evidence that they connect this person to this object in any way. It may be just a sign to discriminate where the object is. So in a very simple associative learning argument, they could have just learned by this case, by 8 months of age, whenever someone looks somewhere, there is an object there, so therefore they just look there and then find it. It's not an evidence, not necessarily evidence that they interpret it as a referential signal. It's actually very difficult to demonstrate unambiguously that infants interpret these signals as referential signals. But we figured that there would be one way to do so. So the argument that infants just learn these object locations by just associating head turns or pointing gestures by object appearance, by simple associations. And this is exactly the same what was suggested for word learning as well, that infants' initial word learning would work the same way. So not like in the Baldwin study I showed you, where they didn't associate simply just sights and sounds, but perhaps initially, when you start very early word learning, below 1 year of age, perhaps this is what happens, where they just associate these two kinds of things together. So the idea is that perhaps we can demonstrate that this is real referential understanding if you use situations when there are two different kinds of referential signals, like deictic gestures and words, which refer to objects in completely two different ways, either by just their location or by defining the object class, the object kind, to which something belongs to, and to see whether infants have any intuitions about coreference between these two kinds of referential signals. Let me show you the study and then you will understand it. So infants see something like this. So here, there's not just looking, also there's pointing as well, but she is also talking, right? And in this case, you would expect it to find a duck at the point where she looked at and pointed at. And it's not. Now, if you have learned that whenever someone points to a location, you find an object there, then you would be equally satisfied in both cases. You would find an object there. If you have learned whenever you hear spoon, you will find a spoon, right? You would be equally fine in both cases because you find a spoon, right? So unless you think that the object mentioned by the word should appear at the location, right, where she pointed it. That is, unless you think that these two different kinds of signals co-refer to the very same object, unless you don't find a difference between these two situations, right? But infants do find a difference here. So because they look longer, that is, they are more surprised to see the object at not at the location which was expected. But again, you may argue here that perhaps, again, they just, whenever they hear a word and then they see something, so they just associate these two things together, right? Whenever they hear a word and then they see these pointing objects, and therefore they think that they should appear together because they just co-occur. So how you can argue against this? This is what we did here. So we created situations where they see referential signals, deictic signals, and they hear the word, but they are not coming from the same source. Obviously, they are not coming from the same source. And so we make sure that they understand not coming from the same source because there are two different voices, and they are 1-year-olds who know the difference between male and female voice and so on. But they saw them exactly the same kind of situations. So if they just think whenever these signals occur, then they should find the same thing, then you would expect the same results. If, however, they think that they should expect, they should think that these two signals, the two signals co-refer to the same object, only in cases when they are coming from the same source, then it's not necessarily the case. And this is what we found here. So infants think that the concurrent signals should co-refer to the same thing only if they are coming from the same source. So one more study to show practically the same kind of things. In this case, it's more about understanding of words. So one way to clarify this issue, another way beyond this idea of coreference, is again looking at brain activations in response to referential signals, in this case in response to words. And we used a certain kinds of response from event-related potentials, which is called the N400, which is a well-known signature of semantic priming. So if infants don't understand words referentially, they don't think that they refer to something, that the semantic priming shouldn't occur here. And actually, this was one of the arguments for the case that initial word learning in infants is just purely associative word learning, is not really referential understanding, because infants below 14 months they don't show this effect in certain kinds of studies. So in these kind of studies, what happens is that you show infants an object on a computer screen, let's say an apple, and someone says an apple, or someone says a banana, and you measure the brain activation to these words. And in adults and even older infants, what you find here is this called N400 component. If there is a mismatch between the word and the picture, but the younger infants, they didn't find it. So we thought that there were some problems with those studies, and especially the big problem here is that these studies are completely out of communicative context. So when they see an object and they hear a word from somewhere, I mean, you may infer that probably that word is referring to that object in front of you, but there is no clear indication that that would be the case. So we should try a situation when that's the case. But first, we try to measure this N400 component in adults in a situation where we just change the order. First, they hear the word, and they see the picture, just to test whether you can find the N400 component, and you find a very nice N400 component. So these adults, they hear a word, they see an object. If it is a different object from what they heard, you saw this component. And then we did the same study with infants with some important changes. First, they hear the word not from a loudspeaker from somewhere, but from their mother, who sits next to them, points to the screen and say, "Look, an apple." And then an apple appears, right? So in this case, infants have every reason to assume that, because she is ostensibly addressed, right, that this is communication, right? They don't just hear a word, this is communication for them. And they have a reason to assume that whatever the person is talking about will be around that area to which the mother is pointing. So it looks something like this. You see here an infant. This is what the infant can see at the moment. I don't know whether you can see the speech. It's Hungarian, but she says, "Look, house, look, teddy bear, in Hungarian. And you see that obviously this infant is obviously is understanding that she's being addressed with some communication, and actually that there should be a match between the two. And meanwhile, we are measuring the electrical brain activations here. Okay, and here are the results. We find very clear and nice N400 infants in 9-month-old infants. These are 9-month-old infants at an age where even the parents think that the infants doesn't understand anything beyond their own name and maybe mama, papa. Maybe that's all. So when we use with 9-month-old infants a very limited vocabulary of 12 words, which an average 12-month-old would know, right? We can show that they understand those words. And we can show that they understand those words as semantically loaded words, right? And so they understand their mother when she utters this word as referring to something in front of them. Okay. Yes. Well, we don't know whether we know that. These are the words that 12-month-olds know. So all the pictures and all the words were within this 12 word vocabulary. Yes. But not individually. Individually, we don't know what they know because even the parents think that they don't know anything. Okay. So this was the summary of the second half of the talk. Gaze serves as nonverbal demonstrative reference in humans. And I had an evolutionary argument about the anatomical uniqueness of the human eyes and dissociations between primates and dogs. And more importantly, I showed you that gaze following in infants depends on the presence of ostensive signals and reflects an expectation of a referent object. And that concurrent communicative acts that accompany ostensive signals are expected to co-refer to the same object and semantically match with each other if they are coming from the same source. So this is the summary of the argument. Understanding a communicative intention requires the setting up of a representation of a second-order intention. This can be achieved even if the embedded intention is not fully specified by ostensive signals, which could directly indicate to the receiver that such signals is being addressed by a communicative intention. And newborns are sensitive to the crude forms of these signals and preferentially orient them. And infants follow gaze in ostensive context, which, if you accept the argument that gaze in humans is a communicative referential signal, suggest that they have referential expectations in ostensive context, which actually tied initially tied to this context. And they also expect that concurrent referential signals co-refer to the same referent. So in sum, human infants possess rudimentary cognitive mechanisms to interpret communication addressed to them because they set up a second-order representation for the speaker's communicative intention. And they attempt to feel the content of the implied informative intention by applying assumptions that the context is referential, as I argued today, and generic, as I argued a week ago. Thank you. And these are all the colleagues who contributed to these studies.
So I have a very special question and a more general question. The specific question is whether in the first experiment on referential expectation, where you just have ostensive signals, the woman is looking at points, yeah, and so on and so forth. Okay. Did you try exactly the same thing without ostensive signals in order to test whether it's really reference or seeing that matters? I mean, reference to the object, or just the ability of the agent to see an object, which should be puzzling to an infant. I mean, if The adult was actually turning the head towards an empty space as opposed to not empty, but maybe using the word that applies to one of the two objects, but looking at the other direction. It should be puzzling, but not for the same reason. So did you do that?
We tried that, but it fails immediately because they don't follow the gaze. So as the other studies suggested, when they see someone there, it's not
statically,
looking at them.
That's the static thing.
With just statically, or even dynamically, if there is no indication, they just turn. Okay. Infants at this age, they don't follow the gaze. Okay. So it fails, simply.
And now the theoretical question is, you, when you discussed at the very beginning, when you discussed the mechanisms that could be, that could enable the child to ascribe automatically second-order communicative intention without filling the content of the informative intention, you actually used the, and I'm not sure you mean that, but, or maybe you do, you talked about coding. You said that maybe ostensive signals of three kinds could code the communicative, from the infant's point of view, could be used as a code that the the model or the adult has a communicative intention. Now, obviously, that doesn't apply to the infant's ability to interpret the agent as seeing, right? I mean, you would not say that there's any code between the eye direction of an agent and his epistemic state of seeing or knowing, right? So how seriously do you mean this coding as opposed to inferring? I mean, the ostensive signals are not cues that enable the infant to infer that the agent has a communicative intention as opposed to some cues that enable the child to infer that an agent sees, knows something about an object. I suppose that you would say that an infant must infer that an agent knows something from seeing in a certain direction, but how serious are you in the hypothesis on the speculation that the ostensive signals code an agent's communicative intention for an infant? I mean,
I am very serious about this. So, I mean, because why not? Why not? That's very simply, that doesn't have to be inferential. It doesn't mean that it's never inferential. Many times, maybe it's inferential. You infer that someone is communicating to you. But it is a very simple code system. Whenever you hear Pierre, I mean, in this case, probably not an innate code, but it doesn't matter. It's a very well overlearned signal. It's very reliable that someone is communicating to you. And I think it is a code system. There is nothing wrong with that. And in order to start this process, it's good that it's a code system because you don't need sophisticated inferential abilities. If the at least very simple, rude way they are there from the beginning, then they could actually bootstrap you into learning about ostensive, other ostensive signals, more conventional ostensive signals as well, and other signals as well. So yes.
But so if it's coded, I suppose that they. If there are three kinds of ostensive signals that are whose decoding enables the child to infer, to attribute a communicative intention, are you saying that they all three have to be there at the same time? Two are enough, one may be sufficient. In terms of necessary and sufficient conditions for decoding, what's your view? And that you said there are three kinds. Okay.
Right. So we are running studies to test that, not all three, but at least two. So I think that initially, if one of them is present, that's sufficient for infants. Later, then you can create conflicting situations, right? Then you are an infant, someone is talking infant-directed speech, but doesn't look at you, know I am being addressed or not. So these are good questions, and they have to somehow disambiguate when there are two codes. They don't indicate the same thing. But I think it's a learning process, so there is nothing wrong with it. I think initially, it's just if one of them is there, it's sufficient. And we have some evidence that at 4 months of age, that's the case.
If I may add, It looks like.
Oh. So it can be recorded.
Oh, yeah, okay. It's not such an important point to record. Anyway, so we also look at it as a kind of an evolutionary protected or overdetermined system, so that say you are born blind, you can still react to contingent reactivity at a distance. That these are coming from different modalities, and in fact the contingent reactivity is an amodal relation, and an abstract amodal relation that can be established in several modalities, that they converge on the source of the communicative intention, and if you miss one of them or you are unable to perceive one of them, you are still in the game. So this is, but indeed, it is possible just to use, like, in my last week's talks, in Mother's addressing was enough to induce kind assignment. You didn't have to actually see the person. As it turned out, if you saw the person, they were so engaged with the person that the effect didn't work. You had to cover up the person in that case. But basically, they are of different modalities. They converge on the same functional meaning for the infant, and they support each other in a complicated world of many sources of communicative and informative intentions.
So we have François and Tiziana, Joël. I think other fingers were raised, but I didn't have time to. So just raise your finger again.
I have one question about you seem to consider that gaze and words are both referential devices, and there is coreference when there is a single source, and then there is more or less simultaneous use of the two devices. But there is an alternative possibility, which you sort of alluded to at some point when you mentioned the need for finding arguments for predicates. An alternative is that the words might be predicates, in which case what they would refer to in the sort of more technical sense maybe would be a kind, as you suggested too in a previous lecture, but you could still save your coreference principle, the idea being that if there is predication and reference by the same source, the assumption is that what the predicate applied to is what the reference is to, or something like this.
I agree completely. You are right. Thank you.
So, you say that children like being addressed, they like eye contact. So that's quite evident when you see the video, and they display really pleasure. And so my question is, how much weight you are willing to assign to these emotional components in the functioning of this rudimentary mechanism, innate, that's going to be triggered by these ostensive signals? Because I didn't see any consideration about this emotional.
By emotional components, mean the infant's reaction,
yes,
to these signals.
Affect, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it means they like, and it's important from an evolutionary point of view. It's important, right? If this communication is for their benefit, right, then they should actually like, and just like they should like it, just like as they like feeding, because it's for the benefit to receive something. No, it's not just that at all. The other more important thing is that they don't just like these situations. They express that they like these situations, which is not necessarily for them to like. They could like without expressing, but the expression probably serves another function. It's a feedback to the communicator, right? The feedback that all the adults, you like it, I like it, grandmothers like it very much. It's a feedback to continue the same whatever is happening. So that's another interesting point here. So.
that in two ways. One is that it is reinforcing the parent for having invested into, you know, using her time to name things for you. And so that by the parent, you know, feeling happy for a reactive baby, is more likely to provide more information for you. And the other way is that it's actually a signal of recognition of the meaning. So it's also the online feedback that the communication has been successful. So it's one is a more general kind of a, you know, just let's motivate mother to continue with this kind of activity, while the other is a local, basically a kind of a part of an interaction in which you are giving it feedback that we can go on. I've succeeded in identifying what you you know, refer to, and I recognize the sentence. So let's continue. Bye.
So this is an important role. It plays an important role in this. Is it part of this innate mechanism, but just an enforcement?
These are motivated. I mean, all innate mechanisms have to be. I don't know. These mechanisms are motivated mechanisms. They are, you know, it's pleasurable to look at ostensive signals. You like words. You have to like. You know, words are. People like words even if they don't understand their meaning. They are driven to signatures or signals of communication. They prefer gaze, looking at eyes from the very beginning of life. And they prefer, by the way, this was not mentioned, they also prefer mother's image without having any experience before. And that's true even for newborn babies who are babies of mothers who don't speak and only use sign language to communicate. So the baby doesn't even hear speech through the womb, and he still prefers, he or she still prefers motherly.
Sure. My question is about the necessity, the theoretical necessity of distinguishing a communicative intention from an informational intention from the user's viewpoint, right? The baby. I mean, I understand that you are tempted to identify to the parents and say, yes, I want to communicate to my baby, but from the viewpoint of the baby was receiving signals, ostensive signals. Do you need something else beyond informativeness? I mean, the baby might be motivated to get something informative, that is, to learn something. And that's it. I don't think you need, at this early age, to say, well, he wants to respond to communication. If he has this motivation for information, it seems enough, theoretically, to explain behavior orienting to information and
but
showing expectations.
But ostensive signals don't provide information.
Excuse me?
Ostensive signals don't provide information beyond the information that someone is communicating.
They predict information to come. That's what they do.
The question, sorry, I understand what you're asking, but your question was why the child is motivated to provide feedback, no? Why is she communicating? Am I right that this is what you?
No,
I was trying to make
sense of that. I would have understood.
Yeah, I understand that.
So, make sense of ostensive signals in the most economical way, without having to to attribute to the child the understanding of a communicative intention. If an ostensive signal simply triggers motivation to learn, that is, it predicts informativeness to come.
Right.
That's a predictive signal, okay? An ostensive signal is predictive of what's something to come.
Right.
So you don't need to have first understanding that's communication, and second, there is an information that is going to come. And I think it's more economical from the theoretical viewpoint to say, well, what the child does is waiting for informational affordance. You know,
right.
he will get something that he likes, which is information or of any kind, you know, something that he doesn't yet know. He's motivated to get that. So can't you go a long way with this single motivation, and then maybe later on, when he has the concept of mind reading, whatever, I mean, here the theories may differ, you might want to say that there is more motivation, that is to communicate, create links, and so on.
So that your point is that infants are sensitive to ostensive signals, but these are just temporal predictors, practically, for information. And there is no deeper inherent relation. They don't think that there's a deeper inherent relation, so they don't think that there should be a second order relation. So,
exactly.
This could be the case.
In that case, they would be different whether the ostensive signals addressed to them or to somebody else.
Yes.
So the fact that
but
they care, that
no, no, I mean,
no, that's no, no, a different issue.
Well, it depends on what kind of ostensive signal. Young infants, they don't see the difference between eye contact between people and non-eye contact. So there's no evidence that they can discriminate eye contact between third parties if they are not addressed to them. So for infant-directed speech, of course, they don't. It's not clear whether they're addressed to them or not. It's a probabilistic signal. It's very likely that they're addressed to them. But the issue is not here whether they can. So what I wanted to say here is that, so you see that there are predictive relations only. But there are cases which could discriminate between these two. For example, the source of the two signals. So if I am right, then infants should expect that the information would come from the same source as the ostensive signals. And I think, I mean, so far we only have those kind of cases and others, not others. And I guess, I mean, some indications in the coreference study is there. So if someone a certain person talks to the baby and another start to talk, then they are not as sensitive to that information. Well, these are older infants, not exactly addressing the issue, but something like that could be done in infants to see whether that is the case. And also, if I am right, so there's a strong prediction here that if I'm right, that infant then that they should, if they set up a second order representing a second order intention, then they should be sensitive to the possibility of misbinding, right? Because then they should be sensitive that there could be information there which is related to that, and there could be information that is not related to that, and it's important to find the actual one that is the content of the informative intention that corresponding to this communicative intention. And so it's not yet clear. But these are empirical distinguishable options.
I mean, this is something we don't have evidence for, but it, you know, it would be, if we had, it could answer your another aspect of your question, is that it has to do with relevance. So if what you are looking for is informativeness. But if informativeness is informative because it's relevant for me. So then the addressing assures that the information that is out there will be not just any kind of information, but it will be information directed to me, and it will be relevant to me, and who is ostensibly being addressed is identifying basically grounding the computations for relevance, because it is gonna be, the addressee has to be the anchoring point for identifying, constraining the content in terms of relevance. So that would be the further prediction that when you have ostension that drives you to information, you are expecting, it's built in expectation that you can actually build on when interpreting the manifestation of information, is that it will be relevant to my or our common purposes. And that that is highly relevant in helping constraining the infant's inferences of how to interpret the message, the presumption of relevance. So that should be kind of a further assumption that is triggered by the ostensive signals, although we don't have any direct evidence at this point and at this age for that.
Other questions?
Chris.
Christina?
Evidence, or what is the evidence that the ostensive cues only work if they're directed to the child? So in all the experiments, right, there you direct them to the child, or you direct them to empty space, or they don't, or the ostensive cues aren't there. So if in fact there were someone there, maybe the kid would in fact understand that the ostensive cues are directed towards that other person. Right. What's special about the kid as the recipient of the ostensive cues?
Well, there should be some special about it. Because
there should be, but there's no evidence.
Let's see.
I'm sorry, but I'm getting thinking. I mean, I would add that the point I made is could be relevant, because that would be the directedness of the signal is providing you the kind of the semantic anchoring point for computing relevant information. And it's it's very different if it's directed to somebody else or to you.
I agree.
Don't have the evidence. You're absolutely right.
It's totally different, so it's totally different, but you haven't shown that the kids can't do it just as easily, right? You haven't shown that the kid is actually the special thing, right, as the recipient. Like, maybe it's just as easy to compute the addressee being someone else as it is to compute the addressee being you, right? You just haven't tested it yet.
Right. I mean, it's not as easy, because I mean we know that there's no evidence, at least, that infants below 10 months they would understand direct gaze between third parties. So it's very difficult to test in that way, because then that may be a constraint. If they don't, they can't perceive whether they're looking at each other, they don't perceive the ostensive signals in between them.
The infant-directed speech
is not addressed in that case. Contingency, we could try contingency. So let's see the study with the contingency and the gaze following. So the middle one would be contingent with something else. And then you would think that they should follow the gaze?
I don't know. I mean, I actually don't think that that's what's going to happen, right? Because it's a harder situation. But I'm just saying that you don't really have evidence that it's special to the kid yet, right? It's a reasonable hypothesis, but there's no data.
I mean, don't have evidence, but this is actually how we define ostensive signals, but that they're addressed to the child. So then.
Right.
But I understand your
point. I understand that's why you define it that way, but it seems not.
I understand your point. But since there is not much evidence that they would actually pay attention to third-party communication.
Well, I'm sort of biased, right, because I have a bunch of data that suggests they do.
But you run studies with one-year-olds, and it's for 10 months. For 10 months, there is evidence.
We've run the six-month-old, so, and it's quite similar.
Okay. But that case, what's the ostensive signal? Is there any?
It's the same. It's exactly the same study. So they look towards each other. They speak in a sort of infant-directed way. It's a single word. So it's like, ooh, Koba. Well, not Koba.
But even then, it's a. Sorry about this. We started to dialogue here. But even then, it's a question whether they think that the infants think that these communications are addressed to anyone at all. So then if you want to argue that they understand the addressed nature of that, then you should show as well that this is addressed to a specific person and not to other one. They understand it that way. Yeah, but it's a good point. Yeah.
I have a question to emotions again. So kind of the opposite view of what has already been mentioned. In the task where you said infants expect to find a referent when they follow gaze, when their expectation is violated, so they don't find the duck where they the other yeah. person looked. Are they upset? So it would make sense that they don't only signal positive emotions when contingency is met, when they have been informed, but they should also kind of complain when they're not, when somebody is trying to pull their attention and say, look, and then nothing. Because that way they feed back also, you told me something, you were going to tell me something, but now you're not.
No, in the EEG study with 9 months old, we try to look at it, whether you find any behavioral evidence for something like that, looking at more to the speaker or something. We didn't find anything, any behavioral evidence of that. In the looking time study with 12 months old, it's impossible, but by the time that we measure looking time, the person is not there anymore, so it's not quite clear how they should express their annoyance. But there is a study in 16 months old where something like that you suggest happens here. So that where it's not our study. So it was published 2003. You know the study, yes, Koenig and Eccles, where infants see objects appearing on a screen and hear words from a speaker who is there, and their looking behavior is very clearly suggesting that they recognize when these two things don't match to each other, and they look at look at the speaker by amazement when she says something which is not on the screen. And interestingly, the other way around as well, when the speaker turns back to the scene and she labels the objects correctly, again they are amazed because they think that they shouldn't be the case. So it's a very interesting study, but those are older infants. Well, N400 is a mismatch measurement, but yes. It's semantic mismatch. Yes. So, but.
Are there any more questions? Okay, so then we will thank our speaker and.